Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, and I'm co-host of the channel, along with Robert Talese. In our bi-monthly podcasts, we talk with philosophers about their ideas as expressed in their newly published books. Today's interview is with Paul Thagard, professor of philosophy at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. His latest book, The Cognitive Science of Science, is just out from the MIT Press. We've all heard about scientific revolutions, such as the change from the Ptolemaic geocentric universe to the Copernican heliocentric one, or from the Newtonian mechanical picture of matter and motion to the probabilistic framework of quantum mechanics. Such changes are the meat and potatoes of historians of science and philosophers of science. But another perspective is from the point of view of cognition. Thinking about thinking is what cognitive scientists do, and the cognitive science of science is thinking about how scientists think. For example, how do scientists come up with breakthroughs? What happens when a scientist confronts a new theory that conflicts with an established one? In what ways does her belief system change? And how? What factors can impede her acceptance of a new theory? Such general concerns like these lie behind pressing issues such as global warming. For example, the idea that carbon dioxide being trapped in the atmosphere might cause global warming has been around since 1896. And the link between measured increases in carbon dioxide levels and human activities, such as fossil fuel burning, was made in the 1980s. But it still took a while for scientists to agree, as they do today, that human activity is a major cause of global warming. And there's still disagreement over whether there is any need to take costly action. Thagard presents a comprehensive discussion of some of the critical aspects of how scientists think, including the development of scientific explanations and theories, the process of scientific discovery and creativity, and the process of change in scientific beliefs, from developing and acquiring new concepts to switching from one whole conceptual framework to another. He defends an explanatory coherence view of belief revision, proposes how normativity or values can be incorporated into scientific thinking, proposes a model for explaining resistance to new scientific ideas, and even indicates why so much creative thinking goes on in the shower and during other moments of downtime. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Paul Thagard.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm really happy to have a chance to chat with you about my new book.
Yeah. So the book is the Cognitive Science of Science. Maybe before we get into the specifics of the chapters, we might give a little description of what the Cognitive Science of Science is, and what the general idea is, and what's so special about the cognitive science of science. And in this, I mean, you might mention how you got into this project, and perhaps even into philosophy in general.
Well, lots of people are interested in science because it's such an important part of our world. You find people working in fields like history of science and sociology of science. And, of course, philosophers are familiar with the branch of philosophy called philosophy of science. What makes the cognitive approach different is that it's trying to draw on interdisciplinary way of understanding different kinds of thinking. It's interdisciplinary because it draws not just on one field like philosophy or sociology or history, but on a bunch of fields that have amalgamated over the last 50 or 60 years to try to understand lots of different kinds of thinking, including scientific thinking. So cognitive science combines all these different fields, psychology, neuroscience, computer modeling, and so on. And the cognitive science of science is the attempt to use that common understanding to get a sense of the structure and the growth of scientific knowledge. In philosophy of science, that's traditionally been done by using techniques from formal logic or by drawing on ideas from the history of science. But I think that the cognitive science of science provides a lot of really useful techniques for getting a deeper understanding of what scientific knowledge actually consists of and how it can grow over time.
So how does this connect with your own sort of broader philosophical interests?
Well, going back to my first interest in philosophy, I guess we're more broadly in epistemology, in the theory of knowledge. But already as an undergraduate, I became convinced that the best way to understand the nature of knowledge was to look at the best examples that we have of knowledge, namely scientific examples, which I found far more interesting than the rather mundane things like, how do I know I have a hand, which is a stock and trade of epistemologists. So I became convinced that looking at science, and especially looking at the history of science, was a really valuable way to do epistemology. And shortly after I got my PhD, I had the good fortune to encounter a group of people working in the cognitive sciences and was struck immediately by how much richer an account I could give of the nature of scientific knowledge if I drew on the conceptual repertoire that you get from fields like psychology and artificial intelligence. So I guess I didn't really work with this name, but I started working on the cognitive science of science in the late 70s because I was struck by how much could be added to the usual repertoire of philosophers of science by drawing on the cognitive sciences.
So one of the broader epistemological issues that you start with in the book is the topic of belief revision, right? Of how we go about updating our beliefs when we, are presented with new evidence. And you give what you call an explanatory coherence theory. And I was wondering if you could maybe say what you mean by, if you could give an outline of the explanatory coherence theory, as opposed to its main competitors, I suppose. And then, as I understand it, one of the more unusual features of the explanatory coherence theory is the idea that emotions or emotional attitudes need to be taken account of within the model. So could you explain that view, please?
Yeah. Well, the idea of explanatory coherence has been around in philosophy for a long time. Gilbert Harman developed a lot of the basic ideas back in the 60s. And going back further, Charles Peirce's ideas about abductive inference, I think, are very relevant to thinking about how people form and evaluate beliefs based on what he called abductive reasoning, which is basically considering the extent to which hypotheses provide explanations. Now, in the 80s, I realized that a formal account could be given of explanatory coherence by bringing in ideas from neural network modeling, ideas called connectionist. And so I developed a computer model of explanatory coherence that's now been applied to many, many different cases in the history of science. In my 90s book, Conceptual Revolutions, I showed that it could account for all of the scientific revolutions, cases where beliefs are revised based on new evidence. What I do in this current book is to apply it to a really live current issue in not just in science, but in politics concerning climate change. So I was asked to write an article on belief revision, but I wanted to not simply rehash alternative ideas, but to apply to a new case. And so here's the basic case that applies to climate change. Why is it that the vast majority of scientists now believe that climate change is taking place and is caused by human activity? At the same time that many politicians, especially in the United States, are denying that fact. So there's two things to be explained there. What has made scientists who didn't think much about climate change until the last few decades almost unanimously adopt the view that the cause of global warming is human activity, whereas lots of politicians and oil company executives want to deny that. So explanatory coherence, I think, applies very well to the case where the scientists are doing it, and I think they're doing it right. Alternative theories would include different kinds of reasoning with probability theory, which people have proposed, or you could go back to something like the confirmation theory that was part of the logical positivist view of belief revision, or recent logic-based accounts of belief revision. But I don't think they can capture in nearly the kind of detail what goes on in evaluating hypotheses such as the climate change ones in the way that the explanatory coherence theory does. Now, one of the virtues, I think, of that theory, because it's intended to be a psychologically plausible one, it's not just an abstract logical model, it's supposed to be normative, but it's also describing what I think people do when they're doing it right, is that you can see ways in which it can break down, and so you can use variations on that theory to explain why there's opposition to theories about climate change. You can explain why, despite the very large amount of evidence that people have accumulated that makes it, I think, highly coherent that climate change is caused by people, there's still lots of people who want to do that. And so I think it's a virtue here that you can see not only why people get the right answer, but you can also see why lots of people are getting it wrong.
So is the resistance by non-scientists, is your theory explaining resistance among scientists and how that resistance gets slowly broken down and why there remains that resistance by non-scientists?
It should be able to do both. In the cases of scientific revolutions that I did, I was able to explain why one theory was dominant at a time, but then lost its dominance because collection of new evidence and the development of alternative theories allowed for the adoption of a new theory that had more explanatory coherence. Famous examples are things like Einstein's theory of relativity or Darwin's theory of evolution. In the case of the climate change, there really isn't much opposition among scientists to the basic claims that climate change is taking place and that people are causing it. It's something like 95% acknowledged by scientists. So there's no opposition there to be explained. The opposition is from the general public and from politicians and from oil company executives, and that requires a different kind of psychological mechanism to explain why it is they're not going along with the scientific consensus.
Uh-huh. Do you have anything to say about why exactly that they're not going along with the consensus?
Sure. In order to do that, I supplement the explanatory coherence theory with an idea drawn from social psychology called motivated inference. Uh-huh. It's something that all of us are prone to. All of us are like theories that are in our own personal interests better than the alternatives. But what motivated inference does is not just wishful thinking. It's not just, I want to believe that, so I will. The psychological process is much more complicated, in which people rely selectively on different kinds of evidence, and so they are looking at the evidence, but then they put it together in a way that isn't the most explanatorily coherent view, but it is coherent with their own personal goals and with their emotions. So it's a kind of emotional coherence that leads people to think, we don't want climate change to be a problem, because then we'd have to do something about the production of greenhouse gases, which would require slowing down the economy or putting brakes on oil company activities. And so people who are highly motivated to keep the economy, especially the oil-based economy, going, have these kinds of motivations or emotional coherence for rejecting the scientific views.
Well, one of the differences actually that struck me was that you mentioned in the book was the broad agreement, as you said, not like 95% or more, of agreement on, you know, human causes of global warming, you know, the fact of global warming and the causes of it. And yet there's also still disagreement about whether we need to do, you know, what we need to do about it with, you know, among scientists. I mean, I don't mean politicians or the general public. Could you maybe say something about, you know, why even among in the scientific community, why that disagreement remains?
Well, there you're getting into a different issue than explanatory coherence. Okay. Explanatory coherence addresses the question of what's true, of what hypotheses you should accept. Yeah. So if you accept the hypotheses that global warming is taking place and that humans are causing it, you're still left the problem of what to do about it. And there you end up with all sorts of different issues. I call that in earlier work deliberative coherence, where you've got to figure out what's the best way to accomplish your goals. And that introduces all sorts of difficult problems. It basically becomes questions not of science, but questions of engineering. What are the best ways to engineer solutions to the climate change problem? And so there are a lot of different possibilities, and it's not at all obvious which of them will work. And so I think that's why there's much more debate about that question than about the actual fact that climate change is taking place and humans are responsible for it.
Okay. So you mentioned truth, which, you know, we assume or many people assume is the goal of science, although not all philosophers of science agree with that. And the idea, and you also link the idea of coherence, not just among, you know, coherence among beliefs, but also a coherence theory of truth, as I take it, rather than say a correspondence theory, or even a deflationary notion.
The explanatory coherence theory is part of the theory of knowledge, not part of the theory of reality. So I think that, in fact, what coherence can get you if you follow the principles of explanatory coherence theory is a theory that at least has a chance of being true. But as you know, there are lots of objections to coherence theories of truth. People can have highly coherent views that are not very well connected with reality at all. You find that in politics. You find it in people who are mentally ill. You find it among cults. So I don't think that coherence is much of a theory of truth. I prefer a more traditional correspondence view. But the claim is that if you're trying to figure out what kind of reasoning will bring you toward theories that are true, I don't know of a better account than the explanatory coherence one. So I reject the view that coherence is truth, but think that it's the best way to try to come up with better and better theories that we can make some claim approximate to the truth in the sense of correspondence.
I see. Okay, so what you what I did note was that you argue for coherence of the right kind as leading to approximate truth. Mm-hmm.
The reason that problem arises is that there have been lots of theories in the history of science that had a fair amount of coherence of that we now know are false. So one of the most famous ones in chemistry is the phlogiston theory. So the phlogiston theory says that the reason things burn is because they're giving off a substance called phlogiston. And this was the dominant view in the 18th century, and it really could explain a lot. I think it was legitimately adopted on the basis of explanatory coherence. But now you have the problem for science. If science can adopt theories that have explanatory coherence that turn out to be false, well, can you ever have much confidence in any theory that has a lot of explanatory coherence? Maybe that's just going to eventually be found to be false as well.
Right.
This has been labeled the pessimistic induction, that all theories turn out eventually to be false. And so different philosophers of science have tried to come up with different ways of responding to the pessimistic induction by, for example, trying to say that something like the phlogiston theory at least maybe got reference right or was partially true. I think that's a mistake. I think it was a theory that we have to acknowledge was the best available in its day, and it was just false. There is no such thing as phlogiston. So the question is, do we have to be pessimistic, or can we find any reason to think that a theory of combustion based on oxygen, which everybody believes today and has for hundreds of years, is going to be a much more sustainable theory than something like the phlogiston theory. And I think the answer is definitely yes. If you manage to see that coherence is something that can involve different levels of explanation, once you see that oxygen, when it was directly proposed by Lavoisier as an alternative to the phlogiston theory, was just battling it out on one level of explanation. But now, with the development of lots of theories in physics and chemistry, we've got a much better idea of how it is that oxygen works. And so we've moved on to what I call deeper explanations that provide some additional reason for thinking that the oxygen theory is true.
So that's the coherence of the right kind is the one in which you get the what you call the deepening and the widening, I believe, right?
Well, all of the explanatorily coherent theories have widening. So phlogiston could explain quite a few things, and it explained more things as it went along. But no one could ever figure out how phlogiston worked. In fact, it seemed absolutely weird that, especially once Lavoisier found out that when you burn things, they actually gain weight rather than losing it. And so it had a lot of problems with it. No one could figure out how phlogiston works. Whereas now we know how oxygen works because we know how atoms form into molecules, and we know how subatomic particles form into atoms, and so there's been a lot of deepening there. So if you, in cases where you've got a theory that's gotten better and better in the sense of explaining more, that's what widening is, but it also has got better and better because we can see the underlying mechanisms that make it work. I think in those cases, we've got pretty good grounds for thinking that the theory isn't going to end up in the dustbin of history along with the phlogiston theory.
So the pessimistic induction that, you know, eventually any scientific theory will be proven or will be shown to be false in the long run, you disagree with that?
Yeah, I think it was a pretty good summary or induction from a lot of early cases in science up to, say, the 19th century. But there have been many cases since then where we see theories that have survived very well, and they've just gotten deeper and deeper. A great example is Darwin's theory of evolution. When Darwin proposed his theory of evolution by natural selection, it deservedly got accepted because it had a great deal of a coherence with lots of different facts. But no one really knew how some of the aspects of it are going to work. In particular, Darwin didn't have a good theory of how it is that when there's variation in parents, they pass those variations on to their offspring. He didn't have a good theory of variation. He had a really kind of ad hoc one. But in the 20th century, genetic theory developed, and that provided a deepened explanation of how the variations that need to be passed on from the parents in one species to their children can operate. And so that's a wonderful example of a theory that's been deepened and thereby got additional explanatory coherence. So like the oxygen theory, Darwin's theory, I don't think, is going to be overturned because it's gotten broader and broader over the years, but it's also got deeper and deeper over the years through the identification of the mechanisms by which it operates.
So in a sense, in major areas of science, we can sort of see an end of science in a way, other than, you know, just sort of day-to-day activities. But a sense where maybe just there aren't any more revolutions to happen, it's over?
Oh, I don't see any prospect for the end of science, given that all current theories have some problems. Just look at, for example, what's happened in biology in the last decade. People thought they had genetics sorted out, but in the last decade, people have realized that the simple model that genes produce proteins that can lead to different behaviors was not right at all, and that the genes have to be chemically modified in order to do a lot of interesting things. This is called the theory of epigenetics. So biology is changing quite dramatically right now. Even in physics, there are people looking for major alternatives to the two dominant theories, relativity theory and quantum theory. Both of them are extremely successful in their own domains. The problem is that they're not compatible with each other.
Yeah.
And so people think there has to be something deeper that can unify them. That's why people are looking for different kinds of quantum gravity theories. So I don't see any prospect at all for for any of this ending. Ideally, we can just keep on getting theories that are wider and theories that are deeper. One of the things that happens, though, in these kinds of developments is you get an understanding that involves not just completely throwing out the old theory, like phlogiston, which turns out to be just a mistake, or the theory that species were divinely created by the decision of a deity. That one does get thrown out along with Darwin's theory of evolution comes along. Uh-huh. But rather, I think it becomes more common to get some understanding of why the old theory was only partially correct. And so you don't actually abandon the old theory. So one classic case of that is when relativity theory came along. It did replace Newton's theory, but people still use Newton's theory all the time for building machines because it's approximately correct if you're not dealing with large gravitational fields. So I don't see any prospect for the end of science, but I think that a lot of the theories we've got now are going to survive at least as components of broader theories.
So I suppose when you said that, you know, you didn't see the prospect of Darwinian, you know, evolutionary theory being overturned. I took that as a case where, you know, within the confine, you know, obviously there are different levels of theorizing, but that basic framework is it, right? And there can be changes, you know, sort of within that framework, but there's no sense in which it makes sense to question that framework at this point in time.
Yeah, and I think it probably will survive in its basic form that there is evolution by natural selection, although the understanding of how natural selection works is something that's still up for grabs. People are still arguing about whether there's selection at the individual level or at the group level. Those issues aren't settled. But the general outlines of evolution by natural selection as Darwin sketched that, I think, is an incredibly good theory that's unlikely to go away. So it's not going to succumb to the pessimistic induction.
Okay. Let me turn to the idea of your discussion of creativity. You know, obviously one of the most important, you know, features of science, one of the most interesting, and one in which you say that, you know, science students need to be sort of shown more, you know, rather than just memorizing these are the facts and these are the theories. But, you know, these are the areas where real creativity and innovation are required. So could you explain a bit about your view of scientific creativity through what you call a combinatorial conjecture?
Sure. Let me just step back a bit, because sure. I think that the whole topics about discovery and creativity are one of the ways in which a cognitive science approach has got enormous advantages over what can be done otherwise. Within a framework of formal logic or within a purely historical account, it becomes hard to explain how it is that people, in this case scientists, get to come up with creative new ideas. And it was really an interest in discovery, when people like Darwin, that most intrigued me about looking to cognitive science. And initially, back in the early days of cognitive science, psychological models were the best way to go. But one thing that's happening now that I think is really exciting in cognitive science is it's increasingly possible, both theoretically and empirically, to look at the brain processes that are doing it. So we could think about creativity as involving new concepts, but we can think about concepts as patterns of activity in the brain. Mm-hmm. And so that means we can start to think about the neural processes as well as the psychological processes that are responsible for creativity. Now, one of the psychological processes that people have long been interested in is the idea that new ideas come about just by combining old ones. Many 20th century writers on creativity have discussed it. Margaret Bowden's one of the best known, but the idea actually goes back to the 19th century. So far, I've been able to trace it back to someone with the improbable name of George Washington Bethune, who wrote a book about genius in the middle of the 19th century. But it's an idea that lots of people have had, and I think it's a powerful one, that it's not a mystery where ideas come from. They don't just get pulled out of the air. The way you get new ideas is to combine old ones. So one of the chapters in the book is intended to be a kind of a test of the conjecture that all creativity requires combination of previous representations. Many people have assumed it. In fact, I assumed it. Somebody challenged me on it and said, well, how do you know that that's true? What's the evidence for it? Because people usually just give it anecdotally. They just say, oh, well, we'll think about Darwin. He had evolution and he had natural selection, which he got by analogy to thinking about breeding. And so that's where natural selection comes from. It's definitely a combination. But who says that's all of creativity? So for that chapter, what I decided to do was to take not just one or two case studies, but to look at lots of examples. And in Predictor, I looked at 100 examples of scientific discovery and 100 examples of invention, technological invention, and tried to show that all of them involve combination. So the combinatorial conjecture is the idea that discovery and creativity aren't anything magical. They're just a matter of the mind putting together ideas that it already has into some new sort of package, which I think turns out to be true.
Well, I guess there's two different ways in which one way to think of it is, you know, you put two things together, and another is you put two things together and then something, you know, sort of emerges. There's the idea that composition, you know, something is nothing but the parts, and composition where you get a whole that is something more than the parts. And I wasn't sure which of those two views of combinatorial conjecture regarding concepts you intended.
Oh, there's certainly lots of possibilities for emergent here. I don't think emergence is anything very mystical. Emergence takes place when you end up with a whole having properties that are important that aren't either properties of the parts or a simple sum of the properties of the parts.
Right.
And there's loads of cases in which that happens in science, and I'm perfectly happy to think of the combination of ideas as being one like that. So take the example I gave before. When you take natural processes going on in all different species, and you take the idea of selection, which was familiar to Darwin because he was a breeder, and you put them together, you get natural selection. And that's different from what people were previously talking about as going on in nature. And it's certainly different from what goes on in the breeding experiments where people are quite intentionally trying to produce a dog with a longer nose or something like that. Emergence can definitely happen as a result of the combinations of ideas. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the powerful new explanatory techniques which science is producing all the time.
You also mention in terms of creativity, looking more at creativity in terms of developing new methods, and what occurred to you, you know, this was an area you thought that requires more research, right? It wasn't something that you went into, but it was something that you said is a really fruitful, you know, area for new research. And one of the what occurred to me was optogenetics, right? The new methods of looking at neural activity. Could you maybe say something? You know, I know you didn't write a lot about this in the book. Could you maybe say something about why that's such an interesting new field for looking at in terms of scientific creativity?
Well, I have to say this is something that's currently on my to-do list.
Oh, okay.
I've been calling this procedural creativity.
Uh-huh.
Because I realized after writing that chapter, the chapters on creativity in the book, that this had been neglected. There's lots of work by me and by other people on how new concepts arise from combinations or how new theories can arise from combinations of concepts. But I only realized, partly through some work I've been doing looking at artistic creativity, that the
development of new methods is really important too. We think of things, for example, in literature as the stream of consciousness way of writing that became popular in the early 19th century. So there are new literary techniques in the same way there are scientific techniques like the optogenetics ones you mentioned that are really important. But actually, I don't know any literature at all in any of the fields that are interested in creativity and discovery that have looked at these sorts of methods. So what needs to be done is acquisition of or identification of a lot of different key kinds of procedural creativity that takes place, and I try to get an understanding of the sorts of reasoning or the sorts of combinations that go into them. But I wish I had an answer for you now, but that's intended for a book on creativity I hope to write someday.
Well, and one other thing about creativity was I once came across an interview with Lyle Lovett, in which he says something like, you know, the shower is just so incredibly a creative place to be. And, you know, he's not sure why. It's maybe it's the hot water or something like that. Why is it that some contexts are more conducive to creative thought than others?
Well, one of the chapters in the book is about creativity in computer science, where we found that there are lots of computer scientists that say something very similar to Lyle Lovett. And so what could country music and computer programming have in common? And it does seem that there's something like a shower effect in both cases. I think that has to do with, in fact, the combinatorial process. So when you're doing very focused sort of problem solving, where you're trying to write a song or you're trying to write a computer program, you're usually working with a set of things that are assembled. You've got the things in front of you. And so it's particularly creative because you're not bringing things into juxtaposition that aren't normally juxtaposed, which is a crucial part of it. One reason I think that the shower or going for a run or the first thing you wake up in the morning, which is when I tend to be most creative, is because the ideas have been jumbling around, and so they're not subject to the usual kinds of logical reasoning or rule-based problem solving, which is what we do when we're really focusing on something. So I think the reason that showers and other kinds of relaxation activities can be really creative, it's because you get away from the standard stock of ideas that you normally have active at a time, and you get the chance to jumble together things that weren't previously connected.
So given the combinatorial, you know, a conjecture that you make, do you think there's some sort of basic set of concepts, like a periodic table of concepts that we kind of consistently call upon to build up the larger concepts?
Maybe down at some really fundamental level. I'm sure you're aware of the disputes in the history of philosophy and in current cognitive science about the extent to which ideas are innate.
Right.
So there's got to be some basic things like the nature of object or the nature of number that seem to be either born into every human being or at least learned very, very fast. And so that sort of thing would be the primitives. But that's not very explanatory for the really interesting kinds of creativity in science or the arts, because by the time you're doing creative things as an adult, I don't think you're working with these primitives anymore. You're working with the ideas that have been built up over decades of work and that have gotten far away from the primitives. So it's not a way of combining the primitive ideas that babies are born with or acquire right away. It's rather a matter of taking the stock of ideas that are around in the science of the time and coming with new ways to combine them.
So let me just get more specific on the concept or the issue of conceptual change, which has gotten a lot of attention throughout the philosophy of science, and in particular, from Thomas Kuhn and the whole issue of incommensurability between conceptual frameworks. So you present a nice series of examples in which you're comparing different conceptual frameworks for explaining theological, qualitative, and mechanistic. And of course, this is very very relevant today when we're talking about explaining the mind mechanistically through neuroscience and down from there to, you know, lower biological mechanisms. So maybe you could say something about the difference between these frameworks, maybe going through one of your examples, and then I guess how you bridge the incommensurability issue.
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating question. So maybe the best example to pick is the one where most people are more familiar with, and I am too, is just the question of mind. How do we understand how mind works? So traditionally, and among people who still have traditional views, the basic understanding of mind is theological. And the mind is the soul. It's something that God made to enable people to think with. And so that would be the explanation. Now, obviously not a very good scientific explanation, and I think it's being superseded by ideas from psychology and neuroscience, but still, for lots of people, that's the dominant way in which they think about the mind as the soul, which is a theological idea. It's tied in with ideas about immortality, with ideas about free will that many people naturally find very appealing. So that's the theological view of the mind. Qualitative ideas are ones where you try to associate some kind of a feature with the mind, not necessarily a theological feature, but something that's supposed to be a special property. Perhaps a better example of that, it comes from biology, where people had theories of life in the 19th century that said that things are alive because they have a vital force. Some versions of dualism that aren't theological are a bit like that too. I think that there's properties of mental phenomena that are just qualitatively different from anything physical. What I think has happened routinely, though, in the philosophy, in the history of science, is that the theological and the qualitative explanations have given way to a mechanistic one. Well, what do I mean by mechanism? There's lots of really great work on mechanisms in recent philosophy of science. The basic idea is quite simple. A mechanism is a system of parts that interact to produce changes. We're all familiar with mechanisms and things like bicycles, which we can put together, or can openers. But the ancient Greeks had the insight that things that don't look terribly mechanistic, like minds, actually are. It's all a question of identifying the parts and identifying their interactions and seeing how complex changes can result from that. And I think that's the point that cognitive science has happily arrived at. Mm-hmm. During the 70s and 80s, people talked mostly about mechanisms in terms of mental representations and computational processes, which I think is still a useful way to think about psychological mechanisms. But increasingly, we're able to think about the neural mechanisms that make this work by looking at the parts, namely neurons and populations of neurons, and looking at their interactions through excitation and inhibition that leads to neural firing, and getting a sense of how these simple cells can actually do something as complicated as produce human thinking. So I think in the case of mind, we're in a quite exciting stage right now, that in an earlier book, The Brain and the Meaning of Life, I called the Brain Revolution. Mm-hmm. This really is a conceptual revolution of major proportions, where old ideas about the mind as something that's just theological or something that's qualitatively different from physical processes turns out to be understandable in quite a deep way by looking at neural processes.
Do you see the representations, you know, the, I guess, old computational sorts of models? How do you see those fitting into this new neuromechanistic approach?
How do I see what fitting in with
the you know, what you mentioned about, you know, mental representations and I guess the sort of the older computational models of information processing?
I think that all these older ideas of information processing are now integratable with new neural ideas. So the very last chapter of the book provides a hint of how I think this is starting to work. I give an account of what I think scientific concepts are, in terms of some very new ideas about how neural processes operate that originate with my colleague, Chris Eliasmith. He's got a book coming out later in the year from Oxford that I think is actually, revolutionary might be too strong, but momentous certainly isn't. What he's developed is ways of thinking about scientific concepts or concepts in general, but also mental representations in general as being carried out by neural networks. The early ideas about neural networks that became prominent in the 80s simply weren't strong enough to account for how different kinds of complex inferences can be made by people when they're doing interesting sorts of problem solving or language use. I think Chris has got an idea that he calls semantic pointers that provides a way of seeing how very simple kinds of neural parts, namely the neurons, the cells, if there's lots of them and they're interacting in complex ways, can carry all the properties that have been attributed to concepts. And so what I did in the last chapter is apply Chris Eliasmith's idea to scientific concepts as a way of getting at a lot of the different aspects that they're supposed to have.
Could you maybe give an example of the application of this theory?
Of the semantic pointer idea?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, to do that, you have to get a sense of what a neural network can do. And so the early neural networks could do things that were sort of concept-like, and that you could have a bunch of neurons connected to each other by excitatory and inhibitory links, and they could serve as a classifier. Mm-hmm. So that you could provide them with some inputs, and then they would give an input, an output that would say something like, oh, that's a cat or that's a dog. What these neural networks weren't any good at, though, was somehow turning that into complex inferences, where you might say that if a dog chases a cat, then the cat runs away. Mm-hmm. That's got complex causal relations. It's got the if-then relation. How on earth can you do something with that with just a bunch of neurons that are spreading activation to each other? I think the semantic pointer idea is powerful because it enables the concepts like cat and dog to operate both in a symbolic mode where they're connected up to each other, where you can say something like, if a dog chases a cat, then the cat runs away, but also while retaining a lot of the representational capacities of the neurons, say for cat and dog, such as, cats have fur and dogs have fur. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of technical, but it's, I think, very powerful, and it's a big part of what should be a next stage of cognitive science, and hence of the cognitive science of science, that we're able to take the explanation of the most complicated kinds of scientific reasoning down to the neural level.
So I just want, before I ask about science education, which I wanted to get to, I mentioned the incommensurability issue in the context of conceptual change. And, Thomas Kuhn's book, as you know, is, I think you mentioned, the most cited book in the history of philosophy of science. And you say that, I'm quoting here, fine-grained and philosophically informed analysis of conceptual development does not support Kuhn's radical claims about scientific revolutions. And I was just wondering if you could, give us a little background on that, response to Kuhn.
Sure. That really goes back to my earlier book, Conceptual Revolutions, and to work by other people who've worked in the history and philosophy of science, people like Nancy Nersessian. Kuhn had some wonderfully bold conjectures about what goes on in the history of science, about it just simply not being cumulative. But I think his boldest conjectures just turned out to be false. His radical claims about incommensurability, saying that people live in different worlds and there's just no way in which they can understand each other, are just wrong. If you look at the history of science, you can see that, in fact, most people during the Darwinian Revolution adopted Darwin's ideas. Most people were, in fact, taken by Lavoisier's idea about oxygen and rejected phlogiston. So that he simply was historically wrong about the degree of incommensurability that was supposed to have operated in those cases. There's certainly lots of interesting kinds of conceptual change. The conceptual frameworks that people are working with are very different. I'm talking about introducing, as part of the brain revolution, that lots of people have been contributing to, that lots of new ideas that weren't there before and that don't fit very well with older theological ideas about the soul. But does that mean they're incommensurable in the sense that no possibility of comprehension? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true at all. I can understand theological ideas, and I think theologians can understand the new neural ideas like semantic pointers. And then they can get involved in what should be the rational process of figuring out which set of ideas have more explanatory coherence. So I think Kuhn simply exaggerated the degree of incommensurability. He was right that conceptual change takes place, and that you need to see that there are different kinds of conceptual schemes that are being operated. But I argued way back in Conceptual Revolutions and published it, I guess that's 20 years ago, in fact, conceptual change isn't a barrier to rationality in science. I guess there's a kind of incommensurability that might be seen to be arising now when you've got science education taking place, where some people just don't want to hear about Darwin. But what's going on there isn't conceptual change in the radical sort that Kuhn was talking about that would prevent understanding. What I argued in the chapter on Darwin in the book, that I actually wrote mostly for science educators, is that you have to appreciate that a big barrier to conceptual change isn't cognitive, it's actually emotional. Mm-hmm. It's not just that people can't understand the ideas, they understand them, they just don't like them. They don't like Darwinian ideas because they're seen as a challenge to religion. Or it's exactly the same as the way that people who work for big oil companies or for provinces like Alberta or states like Texas that depend on the oil industry, they perfectly well understand the evidence that's being proposed for climate change. And they certainly understand the hypothesis that people are causing climate change. They just don't like it.
Well, I mean, this sort of this occurred to me earlier when we were talking about belief or vision among scientists. So there's a sense in which one might say something like, well, you know, if it's one thing to talk about the public being, you know, recalcitrant to these changes because to different ideas because they have these various, you know, religious commitments or personal commitments or economic commitments of some sort. And that's okay because they're not scientists and they're not trying to seek the truth. They're not trying to, you know, objectivity may not be their goal. And so I guess the question is if these sorts of emotional, you want to put that, emotional attitudes are part of a model of belief or vision, even in science, to what extent does that appear to undermine the idea of science pursuing, you know, pursuing truth and being objective, the objectivity of the scientific enterprise?
It makes it really complicated because you can't say that, oh, it should be obvious that if people just manage to plug in the right probabilities, everyone will come to the same conclusion. People aren't probability engines. I think they're coherence engines, and the human mind doesn't neatly compartmentalize into cognitive and emotional components. Everything you know about the brain finds that what we think of as cognitive parts are intensely interconnected with what we think of as the more emotional parts of the brain. And in fact, I think that's a good thing for decision making and also for deciding what's important enough to think about. The fact that emotion and cognition are tightly integrated in the brain is actually a strength, not a weakness, by and large. That's what provides us with the kinds of focus and motivation that can only be put artificially into computers. So that's basically a good thing that we've got that. But we'd have to realize that sometimes it leads to serious distortions. It can allow people who have got the knowledge to recognize climate change as a problem and still continue to ignore it. Or it can allow people who ought to know enough biology to see that evolution by natural selection is a powerful explanation of the origin of species, but nevertheless want to circumvent it. So it shows just how deeply psychological these kinds of conflicts are.
So how would you describe then the notion of objectivity in science?
Partly at the individual level and partly at the social level. Uh-huh. I don't talk in this book much about social processes, although that's certainly an important part of science, where one person's biases are not the same as others. And so having people operate in groups can be one way of at least canceling out the personal motivations. But a lot of it, I think, is just a matter of training and education, so that scientists are, by and large, trained to appreciate how theories can be evaluated based on the evidence. They get a sense of what evidence is. They get a sense of what studies are good and repeatable and robust and done in a reliable way using good instruments. And so that's part of scientific training. And I think it would be a very good thing if people much more broadly had a sense of what the difference is between good evidence and worthless evidence. Something even that I think philosophers could stand to use. You still find people in different kinds of analytic philosophy of mind who think that their own intuitions about stories they've made up about people tell you something about the mind, which is a very different notion of evidence than you'll find in scientists who get a sense through their training and their experience of what makes an experiment good evidence or not.
Yeah. The issue of science education, one of the things that you wrote, I thought was extremely provocative. You said that science education involves cultural remediation and even psychotherapy, in addition to more cognitive kinds of instruction. And so I was wondering, well, does that mean that anyone who's, say, skeptical about the methods of science in favor of religion or, as you just mentioned, you know, the dictates of intuition, is anybody who's skeptical about science in those ways in need of psychotherapy?
Well, I didn't mean to suggest that they were mentally ill. That didn't mean psychotherapy. But I mean, one of the things that psychotherapists tend to do with people is, this is the cognitive kinds of psychotherapy, not Freudian kinds. In cognitive therapy, you get people to talk about what their beliefs are and whether they're based on good evidence and what the goals are and whether they're consistent with other sorts of things. And so you allow people to get a better understanding of the origins of their beliefs, some of which may be false and causing them great distress. So I didn't mean psychotherapy in the sense of curing a mental illness, but taking into account some of the same things. So if you have students, or you can also be teachers, who are highly skeptical of the Darwinian theory, I think it does help to appreciate that what's going on there is not just a matter of explanatory coherence. It's not just that there's an alternative theory, such as the creationist proposed, the modern day ones, I forget what it's called, the theory of
intelligent design.
Yeah, which is supposed to be an alternative theory. But yeah. It's not just a question of an alternative theory that may compete in some legitimate scientific way, given that, in fact, there is a huge amount of evidence for theory of evolution and not very much for this one. The explanation of why people prefer intelligent design can't be, in fact, one that involves explanatory coherence. You have to get into the deeper questions that are intensely emotional, that are tied in with goals. The goal in this case is that people want to retain their traditional religious views. And I think if you try to ignore that and try to say, oh, it's just a question of scientific evidence, you're not going to understand why the large opposition to Darwinian theory still survives in some jurisdictions.
Do you see some sorts of similar obstacles to accepting a more mechanistic view of the mind as well?
Oh, definitely. That's a case where the conceptual change is not just cognitive, it's also emotional.
Yeah.
Lots of people just don't like the idea that mind operates on mechanisms. I get this in teaching quite often, usually by about halfway through my introduction to cognitive science that I teach to 100 students or so a year, I see them starting to well, squirm because they're starting to think, well, does this mean that I'm a robot? And of course, I have to explain to them that there are different kinds of mechanisms and people are much more complicated than any robots that are currently being developed. But people, in this case, students, definitely do find it disconcerting to think that the mind might be open for mechanistic explanations. One of the big issues, which is one of the central topics in philosophy, of course, is the question of what does this do to freedom of the will?
Yeah.
Does this mean that my actions are caused? Does that mean that everything I do is worthless? I don't think it does at all. I wrote my last book, The Brain and the Meaning of Life, to try to argue that even given all that's being learned about neural mechanisms and their incredible success in explaining lots of aspects of human decision making, there are lots of ways in which life can have value and meaning, even though we're going through major conceptual changes and throwing out those old wonderful ideas like immortality and free will.
The two different questions. We're running out of time, but I did want to pursue two strands of what you just said. One is the idea that, you know, we are in this sort of conceptual revolution in a way, and that at some point your students, mine too, you know, sort of say, well, geez, am I just a machine? And of course, it all depends on what you mean by a machine. There are different kinds. And there was a comment that you made in the book the ideas of emergence are hard. I was interested in pursuing, you know, why exactly, why you thought that was. For a final question, the idea of values in science, you know, where values are supposed to, you know, play a role in science when it's not a negative one of, you know, producing bad types of bias. So could you say something about those two issues? One, the emergence.
Yeah, those are both really important, but yeah. I think they're separate.
Yes, they
are.
So
start with emergence. Mickey Chi is a psychologist who's done a lot of work looking at the difficulty that students have in considering processes that are emergent. I think a lot of the problem there comes because people in general have got much too simple a view of causality. We're quite happy with causality where A causes B and maybe B causes C, but where you've got, say, interactions between A and B that are together over time producing C, then people get really confused. So I think it's just a complexity of causation that people don't understand very well. Mm-hmm. It's extremely important for understanding the mind at a couple of different levels, because take something like the notion of a representation. A representation is not usually the property of an individual neuron. It's an emergent property of a whole bunch of neurons interacting with each other. And so that's a kind of emergence of representation that isn't obvious. Similarly, the most complicated sorts of thought processes we have, say, for example, evaluating hypotheses based both on its explanatory and emotional coherence, that's extraordinarily emergent at a higher level. And so without things like the kinds of computer models that we're developing nowadays, it's very hard to understand. So I think that part of the resistance to mechanistic views of mind is difficulty in appreciating these kinds of emergent neural processes. Mm-hmm. But part of it is also tied to values because of the fears that we've been talking about, the fear that this kind of view of mind would counter our values about people's freedom, for example. I don't think there's free will, but I think that autonomy in a different way is actually a very important value that people have, where autonomy means that you're doing things that are not being coerced by other people or that are not happening because you've got some kind of diseased brain function operating. And so autonomy, I think, is a perfectly good value that we can retain. So what sometimes you have to do is when you're engaging in a scientific revolution is to be prepared to change not only your concepts, but also your values in a way that I think can benefit people. I don't go into that much in this book, but in the earlier book on the brain and the meaning of life, I talk a lot about needs. I think that you can have scientifically validated notions about needs that provide an idea of what values people ought to have. And so the question of of emotional values can in fact be addressed in much the same rational way that the question of what are the good explanatory theories. It's different because it is a normative question, but it's definitely open to rational discussion.
Well, that's very, very interesting. It would be great to pursue that, but I think we're out of time. So maybe you could just say a word about what your next project will be after. What the next project is going to be.
Thanks. So a lot of what I'm trying to do now is to expand the explanatory power of the cognitive sciences, psychology and neuroscience, into the social sciences. So a lot of the phenomena we were talking about, saying the spread of ideas about climate change, are social phenomena. They're things that need partly sociological explanations, political explanations, sometimes also economic explanations. And I think there's now enough known about the psychological and the neural processes that it becomes possible to rebuild a lot of the social sciences using these kinds of insights. So this is a project that's sometimes been called cognitive social science that I think is now becoming realizable. So a lot of what I'm doing right now is, in fact, trying to develop the relevance of cognitive science, not just to science, but to the social sciences in general.
Very good. So, thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed talking with you, and I'm sure our listeners will enjoy the hearing about your book.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye. You've been listening to an interview with Paul Thagard, professor of philosophy at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, about his new book, The Cognitive Science of Science, which is just out from the MIT Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed our podcast, and thank you for listening.